Hello, good morning. It is a Stories for Children show, and a good story is a good story. Together, again, we're having a special edition of both of our shows. Virginia was supposed to be on vacation, but as usual, she's not. Neither am I. We're here, right? We're supposed to take vacations. We just don't. And so I wanted to say we have a great show today. We have Emma Dryden, who is an editor and publisher for 25 years and a consultant right now, and she is from Simon & Schuster. And this is great for all of us that are children's writers in Virginia. Hi, Virginia. We'll say hello to you first. Hello,
yeah,
Virginia.
I'm here.
Hi, good. I'm very glad you decided to come today. And we're both here today, and we're going to have a great time today. We also have Jan Britlin with us, and Jan was on your show last week, and it was a great show. And we all have lots of questions, and this is really going to be a really good show. And so I'm just going to talk a few things. I'm going to say what we're doing this week, just so people know. Virginia, you're not on, right, at all?
No, the full month. This is the only show I'm doing in December.
Okay.
I'll be back in 2012.
Okay. Simon has a show.
Yeah,
this week, right?
Is,
okay.
This coming Wednesday, he has a show. And do I know anything
about
it?
And I want to talk
about
him for a second, because, you know, just so we don't forget Simon here, because we talk about a lot of our shows. Simon's show is Wednesday night, and it's once a month. And it's a great show. It's historical fiction. It's so interesting. I mean, he really has a great show. And for those, it's children's. It's young adults and children.
Yeah, it's young adults. And who he has, hold on, I'm pulling it up. I can tell you who he has.
Okay. Yeah, I got all of it here. But, you know, he's just really good. I mean, he's very interesting and he's entertaining. And he's a Canadian, and he just has all these different kind of guests on that are, after as soon as he has them on, I go, like, oh, I want to have them show. He's very good. You know, and then I have a show tomorrow night, which is Sisters in Crime. And that is all about crime and mystery, and it's going to be a great show. It's on at 8 o'clock Central. And we're celebrating 25 years of Sisters in Crime, and we're also going to – I have Sarah Paretsky on a show, which is going to be a private show, another show, with Fran Lewis, and that should be great. And she started Sisters in Crime, and it's going to be a very entertaining show. They're really good writers, and it's going to be fun. And Thursday, I have a show with Wendy Unar, and she's on. She's going to be talking about PR, and we're going to have a great show because we're also having two of her writers on there now, which are Stacey Kaz, and we have Stacey Rourke and Karen Kaz. And they'll be on Thursday. And Friday we have also Dancing with Bear Publishing, the Christmas Anthology. And so this is going to be a very busy week. Every day there's something going on. So that's a good thing. We hope everybody listens. And, I think I'm going to bring on Emma because, I mean, Emma, hi, Emma.
Hello. Hello, everybody.
You have the greatest. I mean, when I was writing it up, I'm going, oh, my God. She has such a resume that's incredible. I mean, you know, not only Simon Schuster, everything you've ever, you know, that you've started at from the very beginning. So do you want to just talk a little bit about how you got in this business and what got you to where you are now, the consultant that you are now, and you're doing a wonderful job.
Well, thank you. Thanks very much. I'm delighted to be here with all of you and your audience. Sure. My sole focus in my work as an editor and as a publisher has been with children's books. And when I say children's, that's everything from board books and picture books for infants through middle grade, young adult, fantasy, fiction, poetry. So it's the whole gamut of work for children. I was an English major in college, as so many of us are, whether we're writers or editors on one side of the desk or the other, and always fancied myself a writer and then never really had the discipline to be a writer. I really admire writers for sticking their tushes in the chairs and producing writing. It's really one of the hardest things to do. So because I didn't feel I had the discipline, and I also enjoy working with people and being in part of a community a little more than writers are, who can be very solitary, I decided that what I thought I might be able to do is work with writers on their writing and on developing their stories and their ideas. And that's really what led to my interest in editorial work. Right out of college, I got an internship with Random House Children's Publishing. And at that time, they had a program through their Human Resources Department where the Human Resources Department would hire potential employees, sit them in different jobs around the company, almost like a temp, and promise at the end of about a year or so that they would place you in their company. And the placement that I got was with their children's division, and I love that because as much as I love working with writers, I also love working with illustrators and artists. I love developing pictures from the sketch stage, sort of visualizing how a book will pace itself, how a book will look, that sort of thing. So that's where I started at Random House in their children's division, was there for several years. And then I went over to Margaret K. McElderry Books, which was at the time part of Macmillan. Margaret McElderry, who just passed away this year at the age of 98, she was one of the first people ever to have an imprint named after her. And it was always children's books. Imports from abroad, as well as original work originating in the States, and worked with her.
I mean, what a career.
Yeah,
she
had a remarkable career, remarkable career, and really was my great mentor and inspiration. And with her, I really learned the editorial craft, learned how to be respectful and sensitive to authors while also delivering perhaps some negative feedback or some ideas for what might need to be changed, and really coming to understand what the relationship is between author and editor, which is really one of great trust, as well as potentially friendship, but mostly of trust, that you share similar goals for making the work as professional and as engaging and as entertaining as possible. Over the years, as things do happen, Macmillan was bought by Simon & Schuster, and so this is an age-old story that many people out there will understand, one company buying another, and in that process, McElderry Books was retained, but we became part of Simon & Schuster. And so over the years, as Margaret started to retire after she was about 85, she decided she needed to stop working quite so much. And I took over her role as the editorial director of her imprint. Then a few years later, I was overseeing that imprint, as well as Athenaeum Books for Young Readers, which is a bit of a larger imprint at Simon & Schuster, again, all children's books. So I ended up overseeing a handful of editors, about 100 books a year, hardcover and paperback, all different ranges and genres. And then in 2009, there was a whole rash of layoffs throughout publishing. And unfortunately, I was one of those who was laid off, along with many other people. And as a result, I figured, what did I have at the end of the day but my expertise? There weren't a
lot
of jobs.
Which is really worth a lot.
So over time, fortunately, I had put in enough time and worked with, you know, over 500 or 600 books over the course of that time, and decided that at the very least, I still had, I thought, a lot to offer in the way of advice about the marketplace. I figured I could still edit books if authors were interested in having me do so, even though I couldn't necessarily promise publication because I was no longer with a company. And so I launched Dryden Books, which, for the sake of the audience, is spelled Drydenbks. And there is a website, drydenbooks.com. And really, I'm offering, as I say, editorial services. I will look at manuscripts and make notes or chat with authors on the phone about their work, always in the scope of the marketplace, what the current marketplace is looking for, and I keep very well apprised through different sources as to what's going on in technology, what the options are for self-publishing, what the options are in digital publishing, as well as just what booksellers are experiencing, what's selling, what's not. I have a lot of friends in publishing, and so I'm keeping as well up to date. Yeah, and so that's where I am now, offering editorial services as well as consulting.
Which brings me to Jan Britland is here. Jan, you want to come in?
Yes.
Jan?
Hello, everyone.
Hi, Jan. Hi, Jan. That's how we found you, because Jan has used your services.
Mm-hmm.
So hi, Jan. She's the author of the series, Roger Dodger series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, The Adventures of Roger Dodger. And yes, I was at a crossroads. Not knowing what to do next, I didn't have a plan. I didn't know I didn't know whether I should put out another book. I am self-published, and I didn't know what to do. So my local book club at the Peace River Center for Writers out of Edison College down here in Florida had Emma and Lee Bennett Hopkins.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And they were going to be talking at the college and for a nominal fee, which I thought was way too low. And I said, I can't afford not to go. And because Emma was one of the first people that I ever submitted a manuscript to in 2009, and by the time my manuscript got to her, she was already gone. And so were many of the other editors that I had researched and thought might be interested in what I had to offer. So that was really what made my decision to self-publish, and I have never regretted that. But I went to hear her speak, and I had researched her and what she was doing now, and I actually hired her to consult on my books and my work and everything else I have that is entailed in my whole project before I even went to hear her speak. Like a breath of fresh air into my business. I now know what I need to do next, and I know where I'm going with it. And it was just such a huge, huge help for me just to know that there's someone with her expertise out there to help us, you know, when
that's
we get in the...
Well, that's the thing, because, you know, I mean, there's, you know, as all of us on the phone know, there are so many children's authors out there. I mean, and Virginia, I mean... Virginia alone, for her Stories for Magazine, she has a mailing list that's huge. I mean, these are people that have written books, too. I mean, there are tons of children's books, and everybody asks the question, okay, here I have a book, now what? And I think a lot of people think if it's a children's book, oh, it's so much easier than an adult book, but I'm here to say this is probably harder than, I think it's harder than an adult book.
I totally think the children's market is the hardest. I mean, especially...
Yeah.
You know, because I teach over at our state college over here in the community ed department, and there, you know, there's a lot of students at Dixie State College who take the course, and then there's, of course, there's a lot of adults who take it in the evening as well, because, you know, there's a lot of people who want to write or have thought about writing in their older years, and the first thing out of my mouth is I ask how many of the students in there want to write for, you know, children and young adults, and I want to say anywhere between 50 to 75% of the people raise their hand. And, of course, I always ask them, well, why is that? And it's always, oh, because, you know, I love children's books, and they're so fun and easy to write. And I just start laughing.
Yeah, I think you all raised very, very good points in that there is this conception in out there in the world. Often, and the perception often comes from writers of adult work, reviewers, that sort of thing, but just the general perception that writing for children is easy. And I think you all raised a very important point, is that it's extremely difficult. And I think one of the reasons is we have a responsibility as editors and authors and illustrators for works for children. We have more of a responsibility to that audience than I think authors do to an audience of adults. Adults, we don't care as much about grammar in books. I mean, I'm generalizing here. But I think adults, we can just walk away from a book if we're not interested in it and move on. We have so much going on in our lives. Children, however, there is an aspect to what we offer children in their books that I don't like to say we're teaching them, because that sounds way too academic, and we're also entertaining. But there is a responsibility also because of all the gatekeepers who exist between the writer of the book and actually the child who's reading that book. There are parents, there are teachers, there are librarians, there are reviewers, there are school boards. There are a vast number of adults in between the creation of the book, like a Roger Dodger that Jan was talking about, and the child. And so I think that alone, it takes a lot of consideration that goes into the creation of books for children. But then in the terms of the craft of the book for children, it matters a great deal. For picture books, for example, how do you tell a story in as few words as possible and still evoke emotion and passion and interest for every turn of that page? What keeps the child's interest? A child, if they're bored, they will tell you right away, and they will walk away, and they will not stick around to hear the book through, no matter how great the pictures are or how much you love it as an adult. And I think, too, then we're dealing with an audience of teenagers who are all going through, and I'm talking young as well as older teens, who are all going through whatever we go through as we are growing up and learning how to become adults. And I think stories can be a great way to impart information to kids, who can make certain kids feel not so alone in their experiences, who can inspire kids to have bigger dreams, perhaps. I think stories serve such a critical need for kids, even if they don't realize it. And so our responsibility to tell really terrific and important stories is that much greater. So it's not easy. Yeah.
I wanted to kind of, I love what you're saying about that. This is Virginia, by the way.
Yeah.
But I want to say the one thing, because I have a teen, and I have almost a two-year-old in my house. So I have the gambit of what children's writers, are targeting for readership, because I have a soon-to-be 16-year-old, soon-to-be 7-year-old, and soon-to-be 2-year-old, okay? So
that
I cover it all.
Gamut.
I cover,
yeah.
Yeah,
you can cover the whole marketplace.
From young adults all the way down to concept books, literally.
Right.
And the one thing that I have noticed, because of how spread out my kids are, I mean, they're anywhere from 8 years to 5 years apart in age, is when I'm reading books with them, or even when I'm working on, because I do a lot of editing, freelance editing as well, and I'll read stuff out loud to my teenage son. And the thing that I have realized, and I realized this back even when I was writing, even before I got into editing, but getting into editing as well, is children are less forgiving. And I know you kind of touched on this, but when you were talking about earlier how, adults like, we can see beyond them, whatever, and just go on to our thing. With kids, I mean, even in our own daily lives, I mean, my children have no problem explaining to me when I'm doing stuff wrong around my house. And I just look, I'm going, I don't know how I've made it all these years of my life until I had you. I mean, that's really what it's like. And I don't, and I think, when you're reading an adult book, we don't think that way because we forget about that. But, I mean, kids have no problem letting us know when they agree or disagree with something.
Right.
And I think that's why children's writing is so difficult, because I think they're the toughest critics out there.
They are.
You're right. Yeah, I think you raise a really good point. And as you were speaking, I was thinking about various books I've worked on over the years, and even in talking with Jan about Roger Dodger. For example, if you're writing a concept book, those kids are going to count everything. If it's a counting book, and they're going to count everything in the illustrations, they're going to make sure the math is right. And if you get it wrong, they will tell you. And, if a rhyme is off, if your story is rhyming and it is meant to be read aloud, and if a kid can't make that sound good to them, they will say, this doesn't work, or this is boring, or whatever it is. And I think as kids get older, I think you're right, too, that I think kids hold their stories to a high standard, and we should too. And they're
and
learning about life, and we're there to help them do that.
that's absolutely right. You know, when I go to schools, it's Marcia speaking, and, you know, when I go to schools, and, you know, the most amazing thing is after I read the book, and then they go, and I'm like, they go, like, can we buy the book? And they can, and I'm going, like, yay, you know, because if they want to buy it after they heard it, it's like, oh,
yeah.
I mean, it's tougher than an adult audience because, you know, if they really like it, if kids like a book, they'll read it over and over and over.
That's
and
right.
To me, that's such a compliment. I mean, I'm, like, thrilled when I go talk to them, and they are tough. But you know what? Every
mm-hmm.
time I go, I learn something else because they are smart, and they also work on books themselves. Now, the teachers, a lot of the teachers are having them make small books so they can learn how to, you know, start it to finish and do the whole thing to all the way through, finish it.
Yes, I think that's another good point is, particularly with picture books, something I say to authors all the time, and I encourage any writers listening to this show to practice this, is to read your work out loud.
Yeah.
And even if you're writing a middle grade novel or even a YA novel, I don't care if it's 400 pages, I still would recommend reading your work out loud. Because, particularly picture books, though, because to your earlier point, picture books are meant to be read over and over and over again. And this is the adults have to be as interested in it as the young child, because it's usually an adult who is reading that book over and over again. But middle grade and young adult, too, there is a rhythm to our writing and a cadence and a form of poetry that does matter. And think about, as Virginia, you were saying, middle grade and some teens are read aloud, too, whether it's at home or in classrooms, or maybe they're reading aloud with a parent or a sibling or a teacher or whatever it is. So this notion of reading aloud becomes a component of books for kids that I don't think does exist nearly as much, if ever, with books for adults. And so it is taking our words on a page and really seeing how they sound almost dramatized. And that's an aspect that becomes, I think, the responsibility of the author as well, to read it aloud and also inspire that love of language. And I think poetry can do a great deal for kids, too. And I'm a huge advocate of poetry, and whether that's rhyming verse or loose, you know, free form. But poetry, I think, can also be a great way to inspire kids to write themselves.
Right, because, you know, right, they, you know what, that's really true, because, you know, a lot of times they don't want to write a long story.
That's right.
You know, and this way, if they can write a poem, it doesn't have to be, you know, because they go by sentences, a lot of the kids, you know, and when they're little, they just don't feel like writing a whole story, you know. And
sure, and they don't have to. They can tell stories through much shorter lines with vivid images and that sort of thing.
You know, because I do scripts, I do screenplays, and that has helped me tremendously redo my children's books over, because I have learned how to edit myself out.
Mm-hmm.
When you do a screenplay, you don't have time to fool around. You have like 90 to 120 pages, so every sentence has to mean something, and dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
So when I did that and I went back to do my children's books, I can see why some of them were rejected, because they just don't read out loud well. You know, and then you have to change it.
Yeah. And, you know, in terms of screenwriting, it leads me to another exercise that sometimes I ask novelists to try, which is to write an entire chapter or an entire scene just through dialogue.
Wow.
And that's not to say that will end up being the final manuscript, but it's a great exercise to see what narrative you can get rid of and allow the characters to express themselves, their feelings, through what they're saying.
Right. That's a good idea.
Well, now that you said that, I really need to focus on writing YA, because I am a huge, that's probably my strongest talent in writing is dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody tells me that. Or like, you can do script writing because it's so great dialogue. I'm like, well, gee, maybe I really need to get out those three books that I have sitting in a drawer waiting for me to
dialogue matters. Dialogue does matter.
Oh, I know it does. No,
it
I know
does.
It
does.
But you know
it
what?
It does.
Because we do shows. Because we're always talking.
I want to go back to picture books really quick.
Sure.
A couple of things, two things with picture books. One, you brought up poetry, which, you know, this is such, I swear, it's like the oxymoron in picture books, because you always hear don't do animals and don't write in rhyme, blah, 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 blah. But then those are always the ones that sell the best. So, like, what? What's the deal with
yeah,
that?
You know, I forgive me if anybody out there disagrees entirely, but I would say ignore those rules. I think the point is, if you're writing rhyme, it's got to work.
Right.
And how you determine that is read it out loud and have somebody read it out loud to you who is not your family member.
Right.
And who is not familiar with your writing. Because you will hear in the reading aloud of rhyming poetry where there are hiccups, where there are stumbling blocks, if the meter suddenly feels off,
right.
and if you have somebody reading it to you who is not familiar with the names that you're using and the characters and all of that, if they stumble over some of the language, that's your tip-off that it's not
right.
working.
Take it out.
And I do think you're right. When it works, rhyming picture books can be absolutely brilliant, and there are handfuls out there. And I think too, we underestimate the value of rhyme and rhythm and just lyricism in terms of helping kids to understand and know our language and the beauty of our language.
My middle child, she actually has a speech impediment. She actually goes to a speech pathologist. So, and I have a slight one and stuff, but. With her being a lot, more severe than I am.
Yeah.
I was using really bad grammar a second ago, so I stopped myself.
That's all right.
Anyway, she's really severe, and so she's been going to a speech pathologist since she was 4 years old. I mean, that's how bad she is.
Uh-huh.
And then, like I said, she's turning 7, and we're still with one. And
okay.
I have learned with her, going with her to her, her sessions and stuff, that rhythm and meter and, all of that is so important, especially with kids who have that problem or have dyslexia, like Jan Brintland, and I had talked about in
last week's show.
You know, that those are, it's crucial. And I think it's so sad, and this is what I was going to go to for the next part about the picture books, is a lot of parents are skipping picture books thinking, oh, they're not important because it's just, they're just too simple, too basic. And I always make the joke, I think it's because all these parents have watched that commercial So Your Baby Can Read too many times and see the three-year-old sitting there reading Charlotte's Web. And I'm like, but the kids don't understand that level of literature, and they're missing the basic, principles of language when they skip over the picture books.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that's right, and I think there was a very there have been some very controversial articles coming out of the New York Times and other places over the last year plus, sort of about do picture books still matter, if you will, and I think all of us here would be the first to say yes, indeed they do matter. But I think your point is right, is that it's been proven over and over that the use of simple language, and I'm not necessarily saying that picture books have to be simplified, but simple language, simple rhythm, with the addition of pictures, can instill in very young children all sorts of, sort of a whole host of things that they need to learn just as their brains are growing in terms of picture recognition, icon recognition, language recognition. It starts to instill a sense of language usage, of very simple punctuation, all those things that do become very important. And I would take this a step further to say that even picture books in a digital format, so they're not book format, and I may be raising some hackles here, but I feel that even books delivered in a digital format can still offer some of that same picture and language recognition and importance. It's a different experience reading a book digitally.
But it's a good experience,
book.
I think it's a good experience.
And I think it can be a good experience. I think the experiences can go in tandem. I don't think digital is replacing books by any means, but it's another form of delivery. So at least if the stories are strong, if the pictures are strong, it's still, what we want to avoid is just what you're talking about, which is sort of parents sort of skipping over picture books. because of this preconceived notion that they're too simplistic or too babyish for my child or whatever it is, because I think we're going to raise this generation of kids who don't know some of the basics of language, let alone what can be instilled through picture books such as manners and how to make friends and some of those very important basic sort of tenets
that we take for granted, that people take for granted that they just learn, but they don't just learn. You know, and the other thing is, how do you feel about this? I know as an agent for all these years and trying to get people out there, I couldn't do it, you know, anymore, because I decided I can't get people's books out there because they want them to be done in a month or so, and it's not going to happen. But, you know, what I find is a lot of people use two adult, you know, in their poetry and in their children's books, they start using adult language and they forget that they're 3 years old. And I think that, like you're saying, simple. I mean, kids should learn new words. And if they want them to learn new words, maybe a glossary would be good or something, you know. But I think a child should understand a little book if they're reading it.
It's very, very important to always keep in mind who your audience is.
Right.
Now, this is something that obviously publishers have a complete handle on. But if you are not affiliated with a publisher and you're just out there on your own, there are some basic kind of rules of the game, if you will. And essentially, picture books, well, let's start with board books, because board books are for even younger. I mean, board books start being used with kids who are 1 and 2 years old. Picture books are really used for kids and with kids between the ages of about 2 and sometimes as high as 6. And then you're getting into early chapter books and readers. It's sort of that in-between step between picture books and easy-to-read novels, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, for picture books particularly, always think about the 3-year-old and the 4-year-old. And I would take that even as far as to say that your main character in a picture book often is going to be identified with that 3 or 4-year-old.
Right.
So it is very important. Now, I wouldn't say that you have to dumb down your text. And,
no,
and a perfect example is a picture book that came out many, many years ago called Chrysanthemum. And it was the name of a character. But chrysanthemum is a very complicated word. We don't see it much in adult writing either.
Right,
hard to spell. It has lots of letters in it. It has that weird Y in the middle of it. But it's a brilliant use of language in context.
Yeah.
So that you can give your character a really interesting name like that. Because then the child will have to start to learn the name, hear the word. So there is a way to work in really interesting, fun words that may not be instantly recognizable by a 3-year-old, but that can be read aloud, can be heard, can then become part of that child's sort of verbal vocabulary without them even realizing it.
Well, I was going to say a perfect example of that is Fancy Nancy with the French words.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how, you know, when she uses, you know, certain words, she'll just to say, and then she'll tell you what it is in basic English, what it means. So you're right. I think, you know, definitely it's how you build those words in with the context around it.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, I wanted to ask a question. I wanted to know your opinion on something, which comes up all the time. Now, do you think that it's the right time now for all these small, I think it is, but, you know, for small publishers to try to, you know, grow their authors at this time if they want to open a public, you know, if they want to come out? Like, there's a lot of small publishers. I think it's probably a good time. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I talk a lot about this with my clients. It's a very, very exciting time right now in publishing. It's also a kind of devastating time in publishing. And the devastating part is that we see so much going on at the large traditional houses, and we're talking, you know, Harper and Random House, Simon & Schuster, Penguin, those huge houses. Where there are a lot of layoffs, there's a lot of movement of editors and designers. You know, as Jan was saying, she had this list of editors she wanted to submit to, and by the time she was ready to do so, the editors were gone from that house, that kind of thing. There is a lot of that. Also attached to that are the business goals for the very large houses. They have to sell enormous numbers of copies of books in order to make a profit for
right.
themselves as well as for the authors. So the stakes are extremely high at the large houses. I think what we're starting to see is that some of the smaller established houses, and I'll name a few if that's okay. I'm
that's
thinking,
good. That's fine. That would be
Marshall
good.
Cavendish, Albert Whitman, Boyd's Mills Press. There are smaller houses who are established. I'm not talking startups.
But
now.
Albert Whitman, you know, how long have they been
yeah.
in business? Like
they've
for 100
been around
for 100
many,
years,
many,
like
many years.
Forever.
Many,
yeah,
many
they really
years.
Are. Somebody
and,
else
and
has
they're
bought
all,
them.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're all changing their kind of image.
Yeah.
They're all becoming much more competitive, but they also are retaining their small feel. And what's very interesting to note is that every single small house that I've mentioned, and I'll also include Chronicle in there out on the West Coast, is
right.
that now there are editors and publishers at those small houses who came from large houses.
Right.
Because of this shift of editors leaving some of the larger houses, they are getting either affiliated with or snapped up by or consulting with some of the small houses. So you're getting very high-quality editorial people as well as design people
right.
at some of the smaller houses. So there are great opportunities there. And then I'll just add that these smaller houses, yes, they may have less money to spend than the larger houses, but they have great people. They have the time to spend. And
right.
I think they care as much about the book that sells 5,000 copies as they do a book that could sell a lot more than that. Selling 5,000 copies.
That's a great thing to hear. I mean, it is. Because
it's not a failure
to be shelves,
for a small
right.
house.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, and so I think there should be some open-mindedness now about, working with agents and then having their agents submit to smaller houses as well as larger houses to see what the feedback is. And I think parenthetically, just in terms of the startup publishing houses, of which there are a few, and, you know, we'll see how long they survive, but I think there's a real, it's an exciting time.
I do,
if,
too. I think
if
it's
you're
great.
A bit of a gambler, I think you have to be as willing
yeah.
to
right.
take the risk as
yep.
the developer of the startup
yep.
is.
Yep.
But if you're sort of excited by that, and usually these startup publishing houses often have kind of a 50-50 profit share, that
yes,
kind of thing,
they're
asking the author exactly to sort of share the risk. If you're interested in that, even just with one project, just to see how it goes, how much
right.
money you might be able to make, what the marketing is,
right.
I think there are some really interesting opportunities
there for
authors.
I think so, too. You know,
yeah, and those things can get published a little more quickly.
Right, and, you know, I mean, I think this is a good thing because, I mean, certainly people get rejected. Look, I've been an agent
sure.
all these years, and I know everybody says, get an agent, get an agent, get an agent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as a person that was an agent and tried to get an agent, it's not easy. It is hard. I mean, they, you know, it's really hard. And I just think for me, I've always tried to tell people, look, and certainly with the self-publishing now, thank God, because there are a lot of good books that came out that were self-published that would be just in drawers somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's true. I think, you know, we're in this interesting time right now where because self-publishing and digital publishing, we're still at the very, very beginnings of all
yeah.
of this.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of chaos. I think a lot of people are just throwing things out there to see what will stick. And you know what? Some things will. A lot won't, but some books will. And I think there's opportunity there. You never know who's going to start reading those self-published
right.
books,
yep.
who may tell somebody, who tells somebody else. You can build
exactly.
an audience. Reviewers can start to pay attention to them. You never know. You know, you get talking on a local radio station, and it could go
right.
national fairly quickly. So I wouldn't discount those opportunities. I do think the concern is because there's so much sort of going up online now,
yeah, yeah.
how do you kind of separate the wheat from the chaff? And I think a lot of that has to do with marketing.
Yeah.
And that is sometimes where I will recommend if you are going to self-publish, there two or three critical people I would try to have working with you, which is the editor, a designer, and a marketing person.
Right,
and
right. They have to have marketing.
You get a lot
marketing.
Of freelance yeah. marketing people out there, too.
Jan, did you want to say something, Jan? Because I know that Jan, this is right. This is her subject. Jan, did you want to ask anything?
No, I'm just so enjoying all this information.
Okay.
But you know, you did mention some smaller publishing houses. Which marketing, can you mention marketing places as well? Because there are so many out there, and when I start to research them and I look at how the books that they've, you know, represented are doing, and
mm-hmm.
it's not much better than other books that haven't been. Do you know what I'm saying? I just wonder
yeah,
which
no,
ones.
Yeah, right, because a lot of people
yeah,
are spending
more
a lot of money.
Than,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
because
saying
a lot of people are spending a lot of money and they're not getting what they paid for, but there's no guarantee, though. That's the thing.
Oh, yeah, no, there's never a guarantee in any of mm-hmm. it.
But they're spending enormous amounts of money, and how do they know which are the right people?
Right.
Right. Well, I think that's very important. I mean, I know from there are services that are out there where you can kind of buy packages.
Yeah.
Of perhaps sort of we'll publish your book or we'll put it at least on a platform and we'll offer marketing. I'm not going to speak to individual companies like that, but I would be more wary of those kinds of packages that are being offered. I think they're extremely expensive and not specific enough to the author and the piece of work that needs to be marketed. I think the brilliance of marketing is when you have a devoted individual who is figuring out marketing based on the content of your book, based on where your author lives, based on all sorts of very personal factors to that book. And so saying, I know at least four marketing terrific marketing and publicity people who all came out of large publishing, and who now, for one reason or another, are setting up shop as freelance and working on a whole variety of projects, but who all have told me that they now have really the devoted time to figure out smart marketing, whether it's online or radio or magazine or whatever is required, whatever seems most appropriate. So it's much more targeted to the
mm-hmm.
author and to the work and to the audience, and also anyone who I might recommend would be coming out of children's books.
Right.
And that's a big difference, too. Some of these packages are kind of this blanket marketing.
And children, right.
I don't
it's a different
know.
Market, exactly.
Children's marketing is different from marketing.
Now,
Virginia, for saying that, oh, my goodness.
Virginia does marketing, and then PR marketing, they're going to be on my show Thursday. Now, Virginia and I are going to have a show geared toward this, because Virginia and I talk about this all the time, and Virginia knows
mm-hmm.
great book tours, and, you know,
right.
we're really going to concentrate once a month on having a show like this, because what we see is we see all the people coming to us with all the problems after they've paid a fortune and it doesn't get done, including editing.
Yeah.
Virginia,
oh, yeah,
this is your job.
I've had quite a few people, you know, which is why I started doing, which has now been a year, that I've been doing the World of Ink tours, and right now they've been this last year been geared only to YA to, you know, picture books. And the biggest reason why I did that is, one, I did a blog tour myself, and I'm not saying I didn't enjoy the blog tour. I did.
Uh-huh.
I really did, but I felt some of the blogs I was put on weren't 100% to my readership for a picture
mm-hmm.
book.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So I had quite a few people kept coming to me like, well, you know, you've been doing stories for Children Magazine for 5 years, and it's an online magazine. You already have, ages 3 to 12-year-old, you know, readership established. You do freelance editing now. You know, a lot of people within the YA market, you know, have you ever thought about doing PR? Because that's my background, actually, is marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I finally decided, okay, how can I do virtual tours for people? And so I actually, and I've talked to other people who do virtual tours, and a lot of them will just have, like, a sheet where they'll list all the different authors they're going to tour. And then they have kind of an email list of bloggers that they've dealt with in the past, this old email blast. But then other bloggers can kind of do a Google search, and come across these virtual tour companies, and I'm not saying which ones. I'm not saying they all do this, but there's a handful that do this. And they just kind of sign up for the authors that they think that they would enjoy reading. The problem is the virtual tour company isn't making sure it's a perfect match.
Right.
And that's what I did differently with the World of Ink Tours. I have a list of blogs I follow, I contact, ask if they want to be a host, and then when the tour comes around, I only, you know, I blast them and make sure it's a fit for their blog and my author. Because exactly for that reason, I don't want them on, you know, a mommy blog site that all they're talking about is makeup products.
Right.
When it's,
right.
you know, why
no, you're
exactly
right.
Okay.
Oh. Yeah, and that's why I dropped one of them. I dropped that because, right, because that's exactly right. And most people, you know, we may say what we're saying right here because we do know we've been doing this for years, but the bad part is all these people out there that don't know.
Sure.
And then what happens is they're just disappointed. You know, the part that when you're doing a book tour or any of these type of things doesn't guarantee you're going to sell books, but you are getting out there, which is half the battle. You have to get your name out there.
That's right. That's right. I think sometimes a couple things. I think you're right to be to do your research, and also if you're working with a freelance marketing person, the value of that marketing person is their contact list.
Right.
And they're very, very targeted, and people would pay millions of dollars for some of these contact lists because they are so specific to picture book audience, middle grade, young adult, you know, specific topics and subjects and school curriculum-based and all sorts of things. But I think, too, I mean, marketing is not necessarily a guarantee of sales in kind of an A to B to C way. Sometimes what will, and I found this as a publisher all the time, and this was even through Simon & Schuster Marketing of Books, is that if a sale wasn't made, a connection was made with a bookstore owner or with another author or with somebody who was blogging about something else when they met the author of the book or whatever it is, that those relationships carry on for years. And so if something doesn't result from immediate marketing, you know, this month in December, it may be that you're talking to that person 6 or 7 or 8 months from now, and then you cook up a great plan and sales will come. So there has to be some understanding, too, I think, of this whole business requires some patience. You know, patience to get a manuscript in good shape, patience to wait for an illustrator to really do their work to illustrate, and patience for books and projects to sort of take hold in a crazy, chaotic marketplace.
Right.
Where,
it is. That's exactly right. Crazy, chaotic is what it is.
It is.
You know, there's one question that I know a lot of people ask me, and we talk about this a lot, and I really would like you to address this because I know you can talk about this. Okay. Everybody that writes a children's book, and I mean almost everybody, thinks it can be an animated movie and it can go to Hollywood and it's going to make a fortune. I tell people it's not happening, and they tell me, they go, like, they think that I am off.
I wonder who you're
I know
talking
production
about.
Company. You know. I just
Jan is laughing because Jan and I had a discussion about this for her Roger Dodger series. Yeah, it's a very good question. And, yes, I beg authors to try to focus solely on the writing first. The notion of anything going to animation can take years.
Right.
I know plenty of authors who thought they were getting movie deals, and 10 years later, there's nothing to show for it.
Right. Called an option. I have options.
Business,
you know, hopefully they pick up, but sometimes they don't.
Sometimes you get a little money with an option. It'll tide you over. But to write with animation in mind doesn't work.
Right.
The animation business is more fickle and chaotic than the writing business, I think.
Anything. That's right.
And
that is the most.
And if a book or a series of books doesn't take hold in the marketplace, then no animation company is going to think that there's going to be a market for the animation.
And writing
one
scripts,
example,
though, they write the script as a regular script, though. That's up to the animation company and the screenplay, whatever. If you
That's a good point, too, is that, you know, if a series takes hold and it becomes really, I'm talking global bestseller.
Right.
That's often what these animation companies want for their content.
Yeah, right.
You know, then the animation company is responsible ultimately for the writing of those animations with your characters and your basic storylines. Some authors are very lucky, and illustrators, I should add, and become, you know, collaborators with the animation folk. Very rarely, though.
Right.
Basically, they want you to sit back, take the animation company's money, and not bother them.
Right.
So, you know, it's fine to have sort of a wonderful vision for the work, but to assume that that's where the property's going, I think is premature, and I think then you're not focusing well enough on creating the best book that you can possibly create. You know, I'm thinking of an example of Ian Falconer's Olivia. Those books had to get very well established in the marketplace around the world long before any animation was started in terms of discussion.
I just want to say really quickly, too, about that is, you know, even if they are established books, sometimes even though the option's there, nothing even happens. And I won't say what
That's
author
right.
or what book because I'm going to be nice today to him. But I don't want to get a phone call later. But, you know, I have an author that I know that, you know, he was published with a mid-sized publisher. And his books are really well-known. I mean, there's been a few articles that have even compared them to being like a Harry Potter kind of type storyline. He's become, I think, when the third or fourth book hit, you know, his books hit the New York bestseller list. He's actually now with one of the big guys, and I won't say which one as well, so I don't identify him as easily. But anyways, I know that the series was actually optioned to possibly, you know, become a movie because people just fell in love with it. And that, I want to say, was 3 years ago he told me that. And so far, from what I understand, nothing's happened.
Well,
it doesn't mean
it. It
doesn't mean
that
it won't happen. It could happen.
Right.
It could happen.
Well, look,
nothing has. So even then, you never know.
That's right. It's nothing anyone should count on. If it happens, it's gravy and fine.
Right.
But, you know, I acquired a manuscript for a novel, I think, in, say, like the year 2001, the author had already, the manuscript had been optioned for film to have Al Pacino attached to it. I mean, all great stuff. We published the book. It was a very, very good book, and we edited it hard and got it into good shape because we knew that the book had to stand alone. We couldn't count on any of that knowledge about a possible movie influence the book itself. We wanted it reviewed. We wanted it to stand alone. Well, that movie is still on option, and it's now 2011, almost 2012, and it may happen yet. But that book needed to stand on its own, and we pubbed it, I think, in 2002 or something like that. So it's all very nice. But and I also have an example of a woman whose books were published, bestsellers, award-winning, film option. The film finally did get made, and it was terrible. And the author was not happy, and the film didn't do a whole lot.
Because
I'll just say Aragon's that movie. Aragon is a good example. I mean, I love the Heritage Cycle. I think it's a great series of books. But the Aragon movie, oh my gosh, when I saw, I was like, I don't think they're going to make any more of these books in the movies.
Yeah.
It was bad.
So,
it was
awful. That's it, because, you know, and it's also sometimes by the time they do it, it's outdated. You know, I saw one, I'm not going to even say which one it was, and she's a really good author, and she's got adorable little girl, young adult books, but it came into a movie, and I'm looking at it and thinking, like, they needed to change the script. It's outdated, because you have to, as a script writer, you have to update your scripts. You can't use a phone when you need a cell phone now. You can't. You have to do, as the market gets changing, and you have to change it for now if it's a movie that's now. Unless it's from, you know, 100 years ago, fine, or historical, that's okay. But otherwise, it's got to be now.
I would urge authors to really focus not on the potential movie, the potential plush animals that are going to get made, whatever, the toys, the glitz, the glamour. I would really focus on the story. That's what editors are looking for. That's what agents are looking for. That's what kids are going to want is the best possible and most professionally produced story that you can
Which
make.
Which is one of the reasons why I named my show, like, A Good Story is a Good Story. That's number one.
Yeah.
A good story. And that's
right.
And, you know, and I'm, believe me, I am not jaded because I keep doing this for years. And now I got traditionally published. I have options. I have things that I've been waiting for, but I still have to say the truth. It is hard. You got to keep going, and you can't stop because if you do, you're not going to know if you made it. You know, and
that's
just keep doing it till you get some results. And I do think if people, I look back at my work and go, you know what, it wasn't good. So, I mean, you got to look back and say it's not good. Because as soon as somebody says to me, this is the best thing you've ever read, I already know this is not happening. Because very few good writers say, like, oh, this is fabulous. And screenwriters, they don't go, oh, this is the best. Because it's not. It always needs to be edited and changed somewhat.
Yeah. Well, I think that's right. I think authors, the editorial process and the critique process can be daunting, you know. But I think there is a way to critique and offer criticism and offer suggestion that is very professional, that's very sensitive, and this is where I would argue that freelance editors, if that's a route that some authors want to go, you know, look at our backgrounds. Look at the work we've done. Look at how long we've been editors, because there is a built-in sensitivity to the process that will make authors feel more confident about the process, let alone about, you know, actually doing some revisions with someone's sort of smart feedback attached.
Now, what I wanted to do before, you know, because the show we've been on almost an hour, right, but I want you to say where they can find you and, you know, the services that you offer. So, I mean, because you offer a lot of services that people would need because you have been there, done that, and that really is important. I mean, it does matter.
Sure, no, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. Like I said earlier, I have a website, and that's what I would appreciate people going to first. I think it will sort of answer questions and at least give a perspective of the kind of services I offer. But essentially, for picture books and for novels and for poetry collections and anything like that, there is a very specific submission guideline on my website. And again, the website is www.drydenbks.com, drydenbooks.com. I give very specific guidelines for the submission process. I look at submissions free of charge, take several weeks to determine whether I think I could be of the best possible help to that project. And if so, then I send a proposal. And usually it's a flat fee arrangement. Sometimes it's an hourly rate arrangement. But the fee structure is identified on my website as well in terms of what the average fees are or where the fees start. But I offer everything from, now, Jan Britland and I, for example, I spent some time looking over her materials, making notes, and we had a terrific phone conversation. And I would call that a consultancy. So I did not give Jan written comments or a memo, but we did have a very lively, good conversation. We cited examples from the text and that sort of thing. So I do that a lot. Sometimes I will sit down with a manuscript, usually the novels, and we'll do a very comprehensive memo, often up to, you know, 20 pages sometimes, but really just comprehensive editorial feedback, again, always based on the marketplace, based on the age range for whom the author has told me they want the book to be read by, that kind of thing. And anything in between. And if I don't feel that a project that I can be of the best possible help for whatever reason, I usually refer people to other freelance editors and other websites. So, you know, this is sort of a collaborative effort here among freelance editors whom I respect and who I like. And it may be that I can't do it for the timing. There's usually quite a window between when I can take something on and when I can actually do the work. Sometimes that can be several months. So if that's not going to work for an author, there are other people out there who all have websites and who are all offering these services. And two, it may be that you don't necessarily need a editor, but that you may need to pull together a query letter for an agent, for example. And I do that kind of consulting.
Those are the hard, that's really,
people with query letters.
Right.
Yeah, they are tough, yeah. And they're very important. Figure it that if an agent or an editor gets your query letter, they have about 30 seconds to consider it, and if there's something in it they don't understand or they don't like besides just subject matter, if there's poor punctuation, if there's a misspelling, it's details like that that
yeah.
can get someone not to read your work. So
right.
I do a lot of work, you know, in terms of just the presentation of the material, try to keep it professional.
That's number one. Number one, editing
yeah.
and get, you know,
yeah.
on anything you
yeah.
do, anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it has to be.
I always tell my students or anybody who contacts me, you know, as a freelancer, or just, you know, for some consulting advice on writing, first in my mouth is, I don't care if you go with me, but you need to find at least a freelance editor or some or a writing coach to work with you before you even
mm-hmm.
submit to a publishing house.
Right.
Because
mm-hmm.
you think your work's in good shape, but you need somebody else's eyes on it.
Right.
You really do.
Yeah. I think that's yeah. true, particularly now. I think publishers are acquiring less and less, and if they are acquiring, they're really assuming that the work is going to be very, very polished.
Yeah.
And again, I would also say my experience in the last sort of 5 years is that very few publishing houses are open to unsolicited submissions, and that's why I'm talking about agents, because some publishing houses
right.
won't look at submissions unless it has
right.
an agent attached.
Yeah.
And that's a similar querying process. You still need a cover letter and a good package to submit to agents. And if I may, I'd like to also suggest a great resource, which is the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, which is scbwi.org.
Because you're a board member on that. Right.
I am a board member,
yes,
and I've also used their services for many, many years. I know authors who started out just wishing they could write a picture book who are now award-winning published
right.
authors, and they often cite SCBWI. It's a community, and it's a give and take. I mean, the conversation, if you've liked the conversation we've had today on the radio, just think about going to conferences where you can just have this for a whole weekend of just back
yeah.
and forth and advice and
you know,
reminders and helpful
I have one more question that I think people, this is a big
yeah.
question. Now, when people have their books self-published, I get this all
mm-hmm.
the time, do the top publishers, will they look at books that are self-published? Because everybody wants us to send books to, you know, publishing houses that have already been done.
Right.
How do they view that? I just didn't want to forget asking that one.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I really can't speak specifically to every publisher's policy
on right.
this, but I think in general, I mean, if we had been talking about this 5 years ago, I would have said publishers have kind of a built-in
right.
Concern that self-published work is not professional enough, et
right.
cetera, et cetera. I think that is starting to change. I think we're seeing example after example
okay.
of
good.
Some self-published authors who are being picked up by more mainstream publishers or by agents, for example, or you know, just getting into the publishing system. And there are some authors who are self-publishing and publishing
right.
with
oh.
a large
right.
house.
I think it's great. You know, these are the questions
yeah,
that people ask.
I think there's
ask.
More opportunity. Sure.
Yeah.
Marcia, can I jump in on that? Because,
yeah.
you know, I'm surprised that conversation's never come up between the two of us. I think, you know, I don't want to say that I can specifically say which publishing houses will or will not. But, again,
right.
another great example of that is Christopher Polanyi's book, The Inheritance Cycle. Aragon, the very first book, his parents put their house up on hawk, you know, to self-publish his book. And what made his book successful and did eventually get picked up by one of the bigger publishing houses was because he went to every single book fair imaginable.
Right.
I mean, he talks about this in many interviews where, I mean, basically he had just stacks of books in the trunk of his car, you know, at the age of 18, just basically everywhere he could go and PR his book, he was doing. And because of that, an
that's
editor
right. no,
happened
exactly
to be walking
right.
by. An editor was there at the book festival, picked it up, liked it.
Yeah,
and from there...
And don't just sit at home. Right, right.
Yeah.
Don't just sit at home and think that it's going to happen, because it doesn't happen. And, you know, that's exactly right. You know, and
I think this is also where social media can be very helpful. Not, you know, I think social media is not meant to be the hard sell, but it is meant to be a platform to discuss work and discuss your interests and discuss links. That is a way for some authors to get more people interested in their topic and in their work. And I think what you're describing that Paolini did, I think more and more people are doing that now. So you may have a harder time in terms of the competition.
Right.
But I do think this point of going to book fairs and going to, if you can financially swing it, going to different conferences, whether they're regional or national, just to get more information about the marketplace and what's selling and what's not and how are books being packaged and what are people saying about these books, that can also be very eye-opening, very helpful resource for people.
Yeah, what I wanted to say is I wanted to thank Jan for, you know, introducing Virginia and I to you, because we say this every show. And now, this is because you're on the show now, I think it will give it credibility that not that Virginia and I are incredible, but we say this constantly. I feel like a broken record. And
oh,
I think that you have talked about the things we have trouble conveying to people. They don't think, they think we're not telling them what really is true, and you have repeated.
No, it's true, and listeners, please listen to Marcia and Virginia. It is true. I'm happy to sort of reiterate some of this stuff. You know, it's certainly not rocket science, but there are ways to just stay educated and professional, because remember, this is a business. I know that the creative side of writing and illustrating, it is creative, and it is, it can be manic and it can be exciting and thrilling, but once you are thinking about why you want to be published, which is a legitimate question to ask yourself, then you have to think of this professionally, whether it's self-publishing or publishing through a house or with an agent or whatever it is. Then it's a matter of how do I keep myself professional and educated and, you know, aware of what the considerations are out in the marketplace. That, I think, will help you a great deal.
You've been fabulous, and I cannot thank you enough. And I know Virginia,
oh,
I can talk to Virginia, because I know that with Virginia and I mean, we're just thrilled that you came on the show.
Yes,
and,
yes,
you know, and
Dan,
thank
I want to say, I want to say something that I wish I had met her a year ago. It would have saved me a lot of wheel spinning.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, I mean, what she tells you is what it is. And,
that's
and
right.
It certainly does help you in your business.
Yes,
because
this is a business.
Thank you. Yes, it is.
And anytime, if you ever want to come on just to say something that you're doing or a project that you want to talk about, Virginia and I will be happy to have you on, because you've been a tremendous help to us, because we try to help everybody, and by you being on the show has really made all the difference for me, and I know for Virginia, because we have the same opinions on a lot of most things.
I'm delighted to reiterate the important points of all of this, please just understand, I mean, the beauty of us all talking together is it's just a reminder this is a community. I think particularly in children's books, I would say 99% of anybody in the children's book business cares about the success of other people in the children's book business. You know, of course, there's healthy competition and all of that, but overall, I think we all really want each other to succeed.
I agree.
And to do it well and to maintain really terrific reputations in the business. So happy to participate in that.
Thank you. And Virginia?
Thank you,
Virginia, for coming on the show with me, too. We both did the show. We haven't done one together for a while.
Yeah, I wasn't supposed to be able to make it with all the high winds out where I'm at. We were out, it was sporadic last week with internet and power, so
no,
I was excited it was back.
Right. Right. The other day, I said this on my show, I was looking outside and all of a sudden things are flying through the air, thinking like, this is truly like the Wizard of Oz. I'm, you know, because it's like everything was flying. It was horrible.
Yeah.
But I hope we all have, well, we got a winter. I'm in Chicago, so we know what's going to happen. And Jan's from Chicago, so she knows that she's not here anymore.
No, I'm warm.
And Kirsten,
that's a good thing.
All right,
thank you all for being on the show and for listening.
Thank you.
This will also
thank
be
you.
On iTunes, and this will be on my site in Virginia's, www.michiganavenuemedia. Jan, it'll be on your site too, probably, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
And Virginia?
Yes, and it's on all my sites. You can find it at thewritingmama.blogspot.com and at storiesforchildrenpublishing.com as well. And then we also have it up at Facebook. If you search in Facebook, we actually have a World of Ink Network fan page. So we have all the links to our shows there as well. So.
Great. And Jan, do you want to give your website?
Ask me if they can find the link.
I'm sorry, what?
Jan?
What?
Your website, Jan.
Yeah. Oh, www.rogerdodgerdog.com.
All right. And if anybody, you know, didn't get that down, you can always contact me, and we can get you to Emma and anybody else, all of us. So thank you all for being on the show. It's been a great show, and I loved it, and it's really very – this was very informative. So thank you all for being on the show.
Terrific.
Thank you,
everyone.
Goodbye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.